You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants, and together we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today we're talking about ex situ conservation efforts for rare trees. What ex situ conservation means is that you're protecting species in other places than their native range. And this can come in many different forms. It can come in the form of collections at botanical gardens and seed banks. Now, seed banking is an immensely important component of plant conservation, but what happens to seeds that don't lend well to long-term storage? Well, that is where my guest comes in today. Joining us is Karen Vondervolt, the Science and Conservation Advisor at the Otari Native Botanic Garden in New Zealand, and she specializes in ex situ conservation efforts that involve things like cryopreservation. Don't know what that is? Well, stay tuned, because we're going to get into it, and it's really cool. Before we get to that, though, I have one quick announcement. It was an honor and a privilege to be this week's guest on a very special podcast produced and released by the Morton Arboretum. Head on over to Planted, Finding Your Roots in STEM Careers, and listen as I discuss my journey and experiences with science communication through the lens of Indefensive Plants. I had a blast talking to those two. They're really insightful, and I think what they're doing, especially for people looking to go into careers in science, is really great. So again, go check that out. It's called Planted, Finding Your Roots in STEM Careers, and I will put links in the show notes to this episode. But I don't want to distract you from today's topic anymore. Let's talk about ex situ conservation. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Karen Vondervolt. I hope you enjoy. Awesome. All right. Well, Karen Vondervolt, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Matt. And hello from a cold and rainy New Zealand this morning. I am Karen Vondervolt, or Karen Vondervolt, South African born, but living in New Zealand at the moment. I started my career quite a long time ago, so I won't give my age away, but I started off as a trails ranger in Kruger National Park and studying nature conservation part-time. I really thoroughly enjoyed it, and it gave me a splendid background into all things nature conservation. So plants, animals, resource management, you name it, and then also tourism. I grew a little bit tired of walking with people in the bush and wanted to focus more on research and more into doing real conservation type things. So I joined the Lowveld National Botanical Garden, where I was in charge of the threatened plants collection. A big portion of my time was spent on the cycads, which is a genus in South Africa that's highly threatened. In fact, I think it's the most threatened genus in the world. So they're really, really battling for survival. So it was a very challenging project, a very good project, where we had to manage our collections, hand pollinate them, and then grow these seeds on either for reintroduction back into the wild,
wow,
or outselling it to the public to alleviate the pressure. And then that fund we got, we used to cover maybe less interesting to the public threatened plants. So doing the field, we're going to collect the seed, grow those plants, really get an understanding of what we need to keep these plants in survival and as displacing the botanic garden, but very much a conservation focus on that. And then after a short spell as a senior ecologist for a consulting firm looking at threatened plants and how do we protect our threatened plants from development, I moved to New Zealand in January 2016, where I took up the role as conservation science advisor for Wellington Gardens, which is Wellington being the capital city, and Wellington Gardens consisting of Wellington Botanic Garden and Otari Native Botanic Garden. So my role at the moment is, once again, it's solely focused on threatened plants and how are we going to secure our threatened plants under enormous strain in New Zealand. So there's a lot of pressures as well. Being a small island community, we have enormous endemism, so more than 80% of our plants are endemic to New Zealand.
Wow.
And quite a big portion, so we have about 46% of our plants are also threatened. Our vascular plants are threatened. We're not even talking non-vascular. So a massive task, and not a lot is known about our maybe propagation and storage facilities or storage behavior of our native species. So that's really driving a lot of the work that we're focusing on at the moment.
Wow, that's an awesome trajectory. And I'm really happy that conservation rang true throughout most of, you know, the whole process for you. And it's something, you know, near and dear to my heart. And I know many of my listeners will agree. So it's really great to have someone like you on the podcast to talk about this, especially in the context of all of the biodiversity crises going on across the globe here. But, you know, why plants? I mean, were you always kind of interested in them, or did it just kind of start with you being in the bush, walking around, pointing things out? I mean, when did you start really thinking about plants from a conservation standpoint?
Yeah, that's actually quite an interesting question. And I hate to say this, no, it hasn't always been plants, it's been animals.
It's okay.
Being from Africa, you know, there's a lot of interesting animals that you also deal with. And I know my first book when I was 5 years old was actually Wild Animals of South Africa. So I couldn't read it if I looked at the picture.
Sure.
When I was 7 years old, I had my first fundraising for black rhinos. And at that stage, the black rhinos in South Africa were really, really facing serious extinction. And I remember convincing my classmates that they need to go and mow the lawns and wash cars and bring me the money so we can raise black rhinos. And we were enormously successful. I mean, that was for WWF. They were driving the project, and they actually came to the school and celebrated the success we had with this. And I think we were so young, but everybody just chipped in. I don't think we cracked the highest amount, but it was the commitment from the whole class who contributed to it, and actually the whole school in the end. It was a very small school. So, and then working in Kruger, it was still quite animal-focused, but I was a trails ranger, and people are always so fascinated by the Big Five, but you soon realize that there's just so much more. Yeah, the Big Five is cool and impressive, but there's so much more to it. I mean, if you're walking, so we were walking for 3 days with people in the wilderness area, and when you walk with them, you know, you don't actually see animals that often. So you need to start getting people interested and passionate about other stuff as well. And plants is just a wonderful way to do it. And I started realizing that plants are just so much more interesting than animals, you know, and so little is known about it because animals get so much attention, almost everything's known about them. So plants are just here in the background and nobody really knows. And I started focusing on that, and then I got the role as the 3D plant horticulturist at the local botanic garden. And obviously from there on, I was 100% just focused on plants from there on.
That is fantastic. And you know what? I really do enjoy those because not only does that type of story resonate with me as someone who started off as animals and then later came to plants, but it is that realization, right? Because you did obviously care about nature and the wild spaces and protecting biodiversity. But then that realization to have that plants really are kind of at the base of it all, and they are fascinating organisms in and of themselves. And then the disproportionate attention they get in relation to how cool they are. It's just so nice to see someone that's put it all together and has gone on to do incredible things for plants.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess it's so useful because it's not plants or animals. It's all together, isn't it? It's about the ecology and the biodiversity, and it all fits together. But if you don't focus on plants, you know, you don't have anything left. So if you take them away, you can't restore anything back to it. So it's getting that overall view. But you're quite right. So I've got two very good examples. So I worked with rhinos. I just gave you the example of the black rhino and how we fundraise. And to be fair, it was quite easy. And then later in my career, when I was working at the Lothar National Botanical Garden, I was involved with the cycad. And with the cycad, now to put it in perspective, in South Africa, there's still about 4,000 white rhinos in Kruger. And with some of the cycads we're working with, there's one individual left in the wild, but we do not have compassion for those plants. So even at the highest levels in government, people or the public will very, very quickly jump on board of the rhinos and the poaching. I mean, it's sad, don't get me wrong, it's terrible. But to get that same support for plants is just so much harder. And it's almost people like, oh, well, there's only one left, so we've basically lost the battle, haven't we? So it's so hard to get people to just see the value of the plants. So
yeah,
it's not easy.
Yeah, I mean, that's where kind of telling these passionate stories of interest and intrigue and just trying to use what connected you to it to use that again to talk to other people. Maybe you'll set something off and hopefully at least get people thinking about it a little bit more.
True. That's true.
Sure. And so coming into plant conservation, I mean, any sort of conservation role has got to be at the very least, a little bit intimidating because you are working with such threatened and endangered organisms, right? I mean, there's got to be a kind of a learning curve and almost an apprehension in getting your hands dirty in this field because, you know, the decisions you make can have big implications, especially if, say, there is only one plant left. I mean, what was that like getting into it for you?
Yeah, definitely. Well, what was actually quite interesting is when I moved from South Africa to New Zealand, because everything's different here. So I had quite a long career on South African flora, so I understood it. So the risk you just mentioned, if I took a risk with the cycad, at least I had probably experienced working with cycads before. And then I got into this role, and there were some plants. The other day, actually, we were approached by one of the conservation departments, and the example you just said, they said, Karen, we're down to one plant. Please can you put it into tissue culture, multiply it, so we can have more plants back. And I was like, I have never, ever, ever done this species in tissue culture, and it's not that easy. So you need a lot of plants to consume. So yes, you're quite right, is how much, because research, just by its very nature, we do not always get it right, so we end up killing stuff and learning from it.
Yeah.
But if you kill the last plant that's there, you can say, well, we learned how to kill it, and now we know what to do in the future, but we don't have a future. So you're absolutely right. So it's where do we find that balance? And with this species that I'm referring to, what we actually did is use a surrogate for it, so one of the more common species, to just start playing with the protocol. So at least if we get it wrong, we can get more material, and then when we're confident, how can we probably get them into tissue culture? So that's just the sterile conditions where we manipulate the minerals and vitamins and everything for it to multiply. So we've got that one plant, we're going to make it slightly more, and then we can look at genetics and how much genetics was captured in that one plant and build it on from there. So that's where we are at this stage. But yeah, it's not easy. It's taking that plunge and saying, okay, we've got the skills and the knowledge, and we're going to try it, because not trying is much worse, you know?
Yeah.
Not it's going to result in extinction, so, yeah.
Yeah, no, and it's good to know that there are people trying, right? And that there's ways of approaching this. There's protocols. It's not willy-nilly, but it also means you have to be open to different ideas and try different things and experiment a little bit, which is kind of the fun aspect of it, I would assume, too, is getting, you know, literally getting your hands dirty in some cases, but in other cases, just trying different things, experimenting and getting to learn about plants in the process, right?
Absolutely. And also to just, you know, collaborate with other organizations. So in New Zealand, we've got Plant and Food Research, who is basically focused on crop species. But they've got tremendous knowledge in tissue culture and how to look after plants, because that's what they're doing. So kiwi fruit being a big driver in New Zealand. So going to them and saying, okay, we want to work on this plant. What is your ideas on this? And learning skills from them and getting their opinion. So as you say, it's not willy-nilly. It's not just out of the blue, let's randomly try stuff. But at least it's based on something, and you do bring other expertise in. And it's about forming those bonds with other skilled people and to actually conserve all the plants together.
Very cool. So, okay, you're not native to New Zealand, but you're here now. And it's a unique situation. It's a unique island. And a lot of people will be familiar with it just from, say, Lord of the Rings. But in terms of the flora and the fauna there, I mean, it is so special. And obviously, you can't sum it all up in one episode. We could probably have a whole podcast dedicated to talking about the flora of New Zealand. But, you know, what were some of the learning curves in getting there and trying to familiarize yourself with a totally different flora?
Yeah, well, the learning curve is I think it's still ongoing. And the trees are very big. So a lot of photocards and trees. So a lot of forests. So whether it's a sort of a subtropical forest in the northern part of the country, it's fairly diverse to temperate broadleaf forest as you come down south. The challenge is, first of all, learning those species, but also realizing a lot of them are, and this is just trees at the moment, but a lot of them are so special that a lot of work needs to be done on them, and the orchids as well. So a challenge for that is that a lot of the genuses are unique to New Zealand as well, so you won't even have the background to go. So you'll do an international search, maybe through Kew Millennium Seed Bank, through the seed information database, to look for some of the species, to just understand how am I going to look after the seed when I store them, and there would be no information on it. this year we worked on a number of species. We're like, oh, we'll just quickly go out, collect the seed, it will be straightforward, we'll dry it down and we'll freeze it, which is a normal conventional seed banking method. And when we collect seed, we do the viability test first off. And our first problem was we couldn't break the dormancy.
Oh.
So this really simple project that we just quickly went out to collect the species that's now basically confined to Wellington, so it is quite an important species to conserve, is becoming this very big project because it's got such a complicated dormancy that we can't break. And nobody's done the work on it. So we had this plan of just cryopreserving or seed banking it, and now it's becoming a complicated project. So a lot more lead work into it or lead research into it before we can effectively bank it. So it's dealing with that, but obviously the longer we work here, and once again, we're a team. I'm not on my own.
Sure.
Highly skilled horticulturists and botanists that work with me who has been here all their lives, and they've got tremendous knowledge to share with it. So it's bringing all of that together.
Well, that's exciting, but it's also, you know, intimidating. But at the same time, this is all being done to help do something for the species that are truly unique to this area of the world. And again, if they are lost, then they're gone. So what you've just described is a big part of what we call ex situ conservation, right? Like, what does that mean to you?
Right. So ex situ conservation is really my passionate. It's what I'm all about. So stop me if I get too carried away.
Go, carry.
Ex situ conservation, I'm going to refer to it just in the context of plants, but the same principle applies to zoos and animals. But in terms of plants, it means that we're taking a plant or a part of that plant and we are going to manage it in some way. So let's put it just in terms that's simpler to understand. It either means we go and fetch a cutting or maybe a seed or even pollen or whatever part of the plant, and we're going to either propagate it into a living plant to grow at the botanic garden for conservation or taxonomy or display or whatever. Or we're going to take that seed and we're going to treat the seed in a way, so by lowering the moisture content, and we're going to store it at different temperatures to extend its lifetime. And the purpose of ex situ conservation is to have your material available for restoration. So that in its very nature means that you have to have genetic representation of that species. So I just mentioned, if you go and fetch a cutting, if you get it from one individual, you're not capturing genetic diversity, which means that if you need to restore that plant, and if you're restoring something, it probably means their numbers have decreased significantly or they're gone. If you'd restore it from a very limited genetic pool, they will not be able to be a resilient population or probably not even be able to reproduce. So we go out, we collect preferably seed because they capture the best genetic diversity, and we come back and we do propagation. So we determine if they're viable, and that obviously produces live plants, which then gets planted into our botanic garden as part of a living collection. And as I just mentioned, that becomes then valuable for taxonomic research or pharmaceutical research or any research for that matter. And then the rest of the seed we keep in storage conditions, which will see them last centuries, hopefully, but sometimes decades, centuries, or even beyond if we go into liquid nitrogen.
Wow. Yeah. And this is so vitally important because oftentimes, especially with rare species living on small pieces of land, the thought that anything is left, even if there is a few, you just can't rely on it, conserving it necessarily in the wild where it occurs. You really do have to have this. It's that whole adage of don't put all your eggs in one basket. And by having these stores, you know, for whenever society decides to wake the hell up and start doing something to put the pieces back together in a big way, I mean, this is where it's all going to come from, right?
Yes, absolutely correct in that. And that sort of thing brings us to a interesting debate we sometimes have, and that is that, you know, you shouldn't be waiting for species to become endangered, so their numbers to dwindle, before you do something.
Yeah.
Because then you're already at a limited gene pool, aren't you? So you've already lost genetics from it. But not only that, right in the beginning, we've mentioned how we consume plant material when we learn. So if a species is straightforward to conserve, so by that I mean, some species, a lot of the crop species are stored this way too, but you lower the moisture content to quite low, so 5 to 7% moisture content, and that means you can store the seeds below zero, so minus 18 is general practice. And why you're lowering the moisture content is to prevent ice crystals. So you can think, if you put the tomato in your freezer and you take it out, you know what's happened, it's mushy. So that's the same principle that happens on a cellular level. So that's fairly straightforward. But then there's a big group of plants that you can actually not lower the moisture content. So we term them recalcitrant species. So the moment you lower their moisture content, they actually die. So they can't tolerate that. And a lot of our crop species, coffee is in there, in that group. So is papaya. So is coconut and avocado. So those are the crop species that people are familiar with. But a lot of native species all over the world are also in this category. And they require a lot of research because although they're sensitive to drying, we have to lower that moisture content to take them below zero. So we go into liquid nitrogen, which is almost minus 200 degrees Celsius. And that requires quite a lot of research, but it requires a lot of plant material as well. So if you're now looking at a species that's really threatened and you can only get, for instance, 100 seeds of them, how on earth are you going to figure this out? Because we're looking at thousands of seeds. So it's a really interesting debate. So people always, and everybody, we focus on threatened plants because they're so fragile and they could go, you know, extinct with some or other events occurring. But by doing that, we shouldn't forget that these ones that we still have plenty of seed around, we should also be focusing on. The same with the orchids. Orchids need the fungi to grow with, so they can't germinate in many cases without fungi. And you need to store both of them together. So once they get really rare and you don't have those fungi and you don't know who they are, it becomes so much harder to figure out what's happening to those plants.
Wow. Yeah, and that's a very important sentiment to drive through is that, yes, we need to do something about the rare species, the ones that are going to be lost. But again, the thought that we just only focus on those, you know, that means we're not hitting that filter until they've squeezed through it. And I can't tell you how many times friends, locals around here that do restoration, that do seed propagation stuff that said, you know, I wish I would have grabbed seeds when this plant was in every road ditch because now they're spraying every road ditch and I can't find it anywhere. And it's that situation that repeats itself over and over again.
Indeed, indeed. And you mentioned about in situ conservation. And I think what's important here is to highlight ex situ conservation that never replaces in situ. So in situ being in habitat. It's a complement. But nowadays it's becoming absolutely essential that we have both of those to ensure species survival because there's a lot of plant pathogens as well. That now with climate change, we are seeing them being introduced into various countries. I think in the States, you've got laurel wilt
yes.
at the moment. Yes, so that's a perfect example. So laurel species, a lot of them are recalcitrant. So remember those ones we can't write down. Here in New Zealand, we got myrtle rust 2 years ago, and that's attacking our Myrtaceae species. So it's an astronomical pathogen that's just really expanding its host range every time it gets into a country. And in situ collections or in situ conservation cannot prevent those pathogens from spreading into the population. So that's really important that the two actually gets combined together.
Yeah, I mean, just like collaborations are key to success. I mean, multifaceted approaches to conservation. I mean, anything really, but conservation especially. I mean, there's no ways around it. But again, when they meet in the middle, that is when things really do progress forward, hopefully in a direction that's beneficial.
Absolutely. And if you look at, I mean, this thought process has been around globally for quite some time. And I don't know if you've heard about the Global Strategy for Plant Conservation. It was initiated in 2000 for the first time through the Convention on Biological Diversity. It has targets. It's got 16 targets. And that's the global plant community coming together and saying, listen, guys, what are we going to do? What do we have to do to save our plants on a global scale? So we had it until 2010. 2010 it was revised, and now we're heading into 2020 targets. And those targets, one of the targets is that we need to have 75% of our threatened plants in ex situ collection.
Wow.
And there's a reason behind it, you know, that the world has realized the importance of having ex situ collections because it gives us opportunities, doesn't it? And options to restore where needed. And of course, the other targets focuses on in situ conservation, understanding your diversity, which is the first step. If you don't know you have it, how can you conserve it?
Right.
And then bringing all of that together through education, through restoration, through all of that. So it's a big challenge, but I think we've seen enormous progress in this, in the field in any way. So that is really encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's encouraging too, because you know, people listening, I get a lot of emails asking me like, oh, how do I get involved? I'm not necessarily interested in being outdoors. I like more lab work or vice versa. You know, this means that there are ways that everyone can get a hand in this. That doesn't mean that you have to do this one thing or even just two types of career paths, it means there's a lot of different ways people could get involved and be working towards a solution that everyone can be happy with.
Definitely, definitely. We're a very small garden at Otari, and we use volunteers to help us during the seed collection season. So what's absolutely important, we go out and we collect the seed and we come back, but that seed needs processing and it needs to be done fairly rapidly. You know, you can't have it lying around for the next year. And we have volunteers of all ages coming in to just come and clean seed, and that's really what they want to do. And some volunteers come in and they do the viability tests for us, which is all, it's hugely, hugely important. It has to be done. And anybody can do it. With a little bit of guidance, anybody can do it. And then we've got right up to as students who's coming in and they're volunteering. It's not even part of, they don't get any compensation for it. But they just love being involved in plant conservation. So exactly your point. Everybody can contribute. And then in New Zealand, there's a big drive for restoration of native species. So in our winter season, a lot of people, community groups, go out and replant our native species in areas where they've been decimated, so where it's been transformed. So absolutely, everybody can get involved. There's no reason why people can't be involved in plant conservation.
Awesome. That's really encouraging to hear that. But in thinking about the details of what you do in this, and we'll get into more of the specific examples in a little bit, but this whole idea of putting seeds away frozen somewhere is fascinating because, sure, if you're from the temperate areas that experience a winter, seeds have to deal with freezing temperatures, but not like negative 200 degrees or something like that. And so, yeah, I understand why you do it, to avoid the crystallization process, but it's not like there's been an evolutionary selective pressure for temperatures that low. I mean, sure, some seeds can handle it, but those recalcitrant ones, the ones you mentioned that can't, they just die. Like, what do you even do? I mean, how do you begin with something
right.
like that?
That's a very, very good question. So bear with me. I'm going to give you a little bit of detail because that's going to answer your question.
Fire away.
All right. So in the past, maybe in about the 70s, we thought, okay, there's two groups of seed storage behavior. So we're looking at collecting seed, whether it's crops or native species, whatever, and we want to conserve them for as long as we can. So hopefully decades, centuries, hopefully longer than that. The first group is what I just mentioned. You can lower the moisture content. So we do that by drying them over silica gel or maybe saturated salts or something. Or even in dry climates, you can actually dry them at room conditions, which is not New Zealand, it's too humid. So we lower that moisture content. We go down to 5 to 7%. And then they're ready to go into sub-zero temperatures. Now, they're ready because we've lowered the moisture content. They can't form ice crystals. And then, at the same time, it was realized that there's a big group that we call recalcitrant. And as I mentioned earlier, the moment we start fiddling with their moisture content, they die. They perish. Now, if you just quickly step back and say, okay, what does that mean in nature? The orthodox seeds, so the ones that you can dry down, are those seeds that can sit in the soil for a couple of years and wait for the right conditions to germinate. Your recalcitrant seeds are often tropical species. They're large, fruity type of seeds, and they germinate pretty soon after dispersal. So it does vary a little bit from actually a couple of days up to maybe a couple of months for some of the oak species. But the point is they will germinate quite quickly. They don't sit in the soil. They don't form a soil bank. Right. And then about in the 90s, we realized, no, it's not that quite that straightforward. There's not two groups. There's a group in between that sometimes say, okay, if you dry them down, so we don't lose the viability, but they lose it afterwards. So whether that is because they don't like minus 18 or over time they're unhappy with the fact that you've dried them down, but they don't behave the way we thought they would. So they're also troublesome, but not quite as bad. And then we get to those recalcitrant species. So as I said, those are often the tropical species. When you lower that moisture content, that's it. They go, it depends on which species, but they just go, no, that's me. I'm out of here. I'm dead. It's unfortunately non-negotiable that in some way we have to lower the moisture content. Otherwise, it can't go into anything below zero. Mm. So we're using, with the big seeded species, we actually take the embryos out of the seed. So that involves quite a lot of time and a lot of technique. You get the embryos out and then we play around with different ways to dry them. So we can dry them using a rapid method. So it means that they rapidly go down to quite a low moisture content and then we quickly freeze them. If you're lucky, that works. Otherwise, we need to use some chemicals. It's called the vitrification solution and basically it's antifreeze for the plant. It takes out the water and it puts a chemical in that will not freeze. and then you can put it into liquid nitrogen. We'll get to the liquid nitrogen now. The problem with that antifreeze for the plants is that it's also toxic. So you need to work out how long can you expose this plant material, which is the seed or even pollen or whatever, the embryo, to this vitrification solution before you start seeing a big difference in the viability or even in the vigor. So does it change the way it responds to growing afterwards? So once you optimize that, or the last way you can do it is you can actually create a little chemical, a physical barrier in which you put a capsule around the embryo or the seed, which will then act as a physical barrier for the seeds to not freeze. So it protects them a little bit from that cold shock. And then what we do is we plunge them into liquid nitrogen. So this is quite important, the plunge part, because it means that they freeze at between minus 300 and 500 degrees per second. So that's degrees Celsius second. So it's extremely fast. And the reason is that the ice formation actually only happens at, depends on the composition of the seed, but around minus 20 to minus 80. Oh. So that's when your ice crystals form. So if you can transition them extremely quickly to below minus 80, for argument's sake, degrees Celsius, then they in theory will not form ice crystals. So we need to plunge them into it so that they freeze very, very quickly, and then they can sit there, and then when we rewarm them, that reversal process can also cause ice formation. So they need to thaw once again from minus 196 degrees to room temperature within less than 2 minutes. So we do that in a water bath at about 40 degrees Celsius. But it means that you need to handle your samples almost individually. So you can't look at a bulk. You can't have 100 seeds in one vial and try and do it. They need to almost be in very small batches of maybe 5 or 10.
Jeez.
So that heat transfer happens very quickly.
That is wild.
Yeah, so it is extremely exciting to work with it, but it is also very challenging. And then it goes back to the original statement of you need plant material to understand this. Now, if you've got a recalcitrant species, your option is A, a living collection, or B, something in cryopreservation, which is liquid nitrogen. There's no other alternative for it. So if you've got a pathogen, a living collection is not really the best answer, is it? Because a living collection will always be exposed to that pathogen unless you're treating it, which becomes non-sustainable anyway. So we need to look at cryopreservation for these species. And as I said, there's some, you can just assume from the conversation we had, there's quite a lot of research to be done in it. Because each step you're introducing stresses to this embryo or plant material you're working on. So you need to determine how is that impacting. Because if you've got something in seed storage or liquid nitrogen or whatever, your end goal is to have a normal functioning plant. So I mentioned the vitrification solution can be a little bit toxic. But it can also change the genes and that plantlet doesn't become a normal plantlet in the end.
Whoa.
So we need to make sure that each step that we do, we still maintain an original plant in the end. It doesn't help if they can't grow and function as a plant at the end as well. So it's really, really interesting. And what's very exciting is there's more and more people globally are starting to work on cryopreservation of native species, which is challenging because every species is different as well. So it's not to say, I'm working on this tree species. You can work on your Syzygium or whatever species you're working on my protocol. It doesn't work like that. Each species needs its own protocol. So that's a little bit challenging. But now there's more and more people starting to work on native species. Plant gardens are starting to realize you need to do cryopreservation. And we're learning from each other. So we go to conferences or just making contact and saying, I'm having a lot of trouble with this. What can I do? And we're advising everybody, and we're seeing a lot more progress now in the fields of cryopreservation for plants.
Yeah, that's intense. And I'm really happy there's people like you that enjoy a good challenge.
Indeed.
Wow, that's amazing. And just to think of the process of getting to the point of thinking about cryopreservation there, just the experimenting that goes into saying, is it even possible? But like you said, the idea that each species presents its own unique challenges to this hurdle to get over that, yeah, I mean, oh, my hat's off to you.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I guess that's true. We're finding many, I keep on joking because we've been working on swamp hari, which is a recalcitrant tree in New Zealand, and it's been about 2 years. And I found about 1,000 ways to kill the embryos, but not yet to get them to survive. So, yeah, we do need to keep the bright side up because you spend a lot of time and energy. But you know what? Just one little tweak further and you might crack it. And that's the survival of the species going forward. So, yeah. But it does scare me a little bit when I hear about the likes of Laurel Wolf, like you've got in the States, and probably will make its way at some stage to New Zealand. And I know that some of our really, really important forest trees are also in the laurel family, and they are recalcitrant because we started playing with those embryos. And I know the amount of work I'm doing on swamp wiry and the lead time that I'm dedicating to swamp wiry is going to have to be repeated for Tawai's gear, which is the laurel. So we need people to start working on cryopreservation and native species and understanding what's happening, because time is against us, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, the upside of global travel and the movement of things is we get to experience the world, but the downside is everything that comes with us in the process, including things like laurel wilt and sudden oak death and just the myriad other pathogens. But before we get into the specific examples here, you talked about removing embryos, and that must present a whole different challenge when it comes time to wake those little buggers back up, right?
Yeah, so that is actually the first step when we started looking at swamp wiry or any species, because the same has been done for oaks as well, is how do you get that embryo out of the seed? Because if you stress that embryo, you're going to put you, it's the same as doing an operation on a human being in a hospital. If you cause a lot of stress, even before the operation, the chances of survival becomes less and less. So the first challenge was, how do we get that embryo out of the seed without injuring it or limiting the stress from that embryo? And then this next step is, how do we grow that embryo? Before we even try anything else, can we grow an embryo if we take it out of the seed? So that took, believe it or not, about a year to optimize, because they also need to be sterilized. They come with their own little set of pathogens in the seed. So getting them out quickly, and then sterilizing them and then growing them into a normal plant, as I've been saying before. That was the first step. And then you need to also sort of speed the process up, because the challenge when you deal with a recalcitrant species is that you don't have a lot of time, because the seed loses viability. So you go out and you do your seed collection, and then the clock starts, and you've got about 4 weeks for your seeds, and then you're done with the seed. Doesn't matter if you want more questions answered, that will be the reasonable life expectancy of the seed that I'm working on now.
Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. So now you need to balance excising those embryos in a shortest time possible, but not causing stress. So it's finding that balance. So it is very time consuming, but at least once you know how to excise them, how to sterilize them without causing too much damage, you can start playing with the other variables in it. Oak species, I know as well, the embryos get removed. So the reason we take the embryos out of the seed, it's because the seeds are too big. So the recalcitrant species, the seeds are too big to dry quickly. So you have to work just with the embryo. So embryo rescue being the first step. And some of the species, you need to leave a little bit of the cotyledons on, which then helps them to actually grow back faster. Mm. And some species you can leave the cotyledons off. So even that part just needs to be optimized. And that sounds like a whole lot of work, but no, you actually get the hang of it within about a week or two. And thereafter, you will just optimize as you go along before you start the cryo process.
Whew. And then you have an excised embryo. How the heck do you wake that back up to start growing it into a functioning seedling?
Right, so we've got the excised embryo. We know we can grow them in theory, and then we go on to the next step. So we know we have to get the moisture content down. So let's say if they are in liquid nitrogen, they're asleep, all metabolic activity stops, and that's why we put them at minus 200 degrees Celsius. So they should, in theory, be able to survive for a very, very long time. Then it's now time to wake them up. We put those vials into 40 degrees Celsius water bath, so they go from minus 200 to it's about 10 or 15 degrees. And then we start giving them antioxidants and recovery mixes. And that can either be in a liquid, so we'll put them in the dark, so we'll wrap them in foil so they don't see the light, and they'll be in antioxidants and regrowth material that will leach out all the reactive oxygen species, so all the damage that's been occurred will start repairing itself. and you'll keep them in the dark. You'll keep them usually at about 20 degrees Celsius where it's nice and cozy. And then you'll take them out of that, expose them to the light, and put them onto different media types that we would have worked out before we put them into liquid nitrogen. What do they like? Because some species will do really well if you put some plant growth regulators in there, and the regulators will just signal to the different cells to start growing. But some species don't like it, so it doesn't help putting it in. And like swamp worry, we're realizing they also don't really like the sugar. So if you put too much sugar in there, they don't like it. So optimizing each one's recovery mix for them, and then you'll grow them back in the incubator and see, okay, over time, how quickly do they respond? Do they grow back? And as I say, do they form normal leaves, normal roots? Do they become a normal seedling? So all of these steps needs to be optimized for the species. So right down to the antioxidants or recovery mix that you're using, recovery duration, recovery temperature that you recover them at. So that needs to be optimized for each species. And once you have it, so this all sounds really impossible to achieve, but it's not. Once you have that, you can effectively store hundreds of thousands of seeds in a very short time. So it's just cracking the protocol for the species, which, and I mean, we look, once it becomes challenging, if it's not, some species are straightforward, they will actually respond quite well to cryopreservation, even though they're recalcitrant. They're not that challenging. And some species are. And then we'll start looking at stress markers. So using biochemical analysis to understand exactly where's the stress coming from and then helping to alleviate the stress in each step. So some species, as I say, can just be a little bit more difficult than others.
Wow, that is remarkable. But again, you know, the effort being put up front, huge payoffs in the end, which is storing mass quantities of seed for long periods of time and safeguarding at least some genetic diversity for the future.
Absolutely. And it means that we can restore our species when needed and if needed. And I guess if there are some people, I hope there's not, but who doesn't really think that conservation is that important, actually our food security is also linked to exactly the same.
Right.
So as human beings, that's our food security process as well. So we're looking at the next medicine that we haven't discovered or the next food source that we haven't discovered that we're starting to bank away for the future.
Certainly, yes. And I mean, it goes across many different avenues of interests, but it's survival for all things at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
So, okay, specific examples. I mean, we've mentioned it a couple of times here, is the swamp myrie. What is this tree and what's going on with it that you need to be considering this ex situ conservation efforts here?
Right, so there's a very good clue in the name of the species, which I for some reason failed to see, and that's the word swamp. So, swamp myrie. And then I chose this massive tree growing in swamp to go and work on, which means seed collection is quite challenging. It's a 15 to 20 meter high swamp tree. So it's a tree that used to dominate swamps in New Zealand. Now, the swamps have been drained since the 1800s for pasture, mostly for pasture. There's been growth and infrastructure as well, which means that swamp myrie also got basically destroyed. So we lost 80% of the habitat for swamp myrie. But a phenomenal tree. So as the swamps rise, so the swamps can go up to about a meter and a half, or right down to nothing. This tree sits there and it binds all the soil and all the water and everything in it. So a beautiful tree, a massive keystone species. So by that I mean a species that it forms these beautiful berries that the native birds absolutely depend on as a food source. It's a really, really interesting tree. Now, the reason I focus on swamp myrie, it is a nationally critical species, so critically endangered according to the IUCN criteria. And we're really concerned because I've mentioned the myrtle rust that arrived, and myrtle rust attacks the fruit of this tree. And so you see where this conversation is going. If we don't have fruit, the fleshy fruit, what are we going to do with the species? So I chose that this tree to focus on because it's our only recalcitrant Myrtaceae. So I've always been passionate about the more challenging recalcitrant species. It's a very important keystone species for us in the swamps. It's also a culturally important tree. And as I said, it's just absolutely fundamental to the birds as well. And it's a very important genus globally. So even food sources, our cumin spices, that's also Zygium. So wow. Hopefully some of the techniques can be transferable at least to other Zygium.
But I mean, what a scary situation for a species. Not only is its habitat largely destroyed, but now you add on top of that a complete, you know, or potentially complete knockout of its reproductive efforts. I mean, it's very evident why someone would want to start to tackle this, because for all of the reasons and more that you just outlined, this is something someone needs to get on top of. And it's really nice to hear someone that, again, like you, that loves a good challenge and is ready to face that challenge head on, is in place here. I mean,
that's true. And I guess also for me here is that, you know, it's not always easy to convince people about plants and plant conservation and what should be done. Now, in New Zealand, it's quite unique because I don't know if you've heard of the manuka. So we have manuka honey that's on the global market. So it's a tree species here that's basically a crop species, but it's generating billions of dollars in terms of revenue from the honey that the bees make. And so there's a very big awareness around manuka and the industry and this economic and environmental and social awareness around it. So when I initially arrived in New Zealand, and it's not unique to New Zealand, there wasn't that much support for the work about in situ conservation. But because myrtle rust actually received a lot of attention around here, it was a fantastic vehicle to create awareness for what should be done and how it should be done and how we can use cryopreservation, botanic gardens, plant conservation to secure our future. So, yes, it is challenging, but it was also enormously rewarding to see how people got on board, because people are extremely passionate about our native species here. So realizing what the threat is for myrtle rust, because it was so in our faces when it arrived, and what can be done, really, really enabled us to highlight ex situ conservation as in general. Yeah. So that was really, I guess, a positive out of a very bad situation.
Sure. I mean, take advantage, right?
Definitely.
So where are you at with the process with the swamp myrie? I mean, have you figured out some protocols that are going to work for long-term seed storage, or at least embryo storage of the species?
Yes. So we've come quite a long way. So I've explained to you about the quick drying method and where we use the antifreeze and also where we use the physical barrier. We've tried all of those methods. And just at the end of the last seed batch, we made a breakthrough with the rapid drying technique. So we're basically using a container where we've got a computer fan that dries the embryos. Instead of 8 hours, we dry them in basically 120 minutes or 180 minutes. So that's instead of 8 hours, we do 3 hours. So it's a very rapid drying. And we got them to survive that process, which is phenomenal because they are recovered. And so it's not easy to get them to survive that. So that's really, really promising.
Yay.
And just last week, the embryos went off for biochemical analysis. So what we're looking at is those stress markers in the drying process. How high are they? And then if they are fairly high or what type of markers they are, depending on whether we can add antioxidants. So we've got a whole plan up for the next season. And I believe we do have the breakthrough in the drying we've just achieved. But we've also made quite a lot of progress in the chemical treatment. We realized that if you put the chemical treatment under pressure, so if you do it in a vacuum pump, they actually respond better because the exposure time gets less, but they still take up the same amount of the solution. So that has been optimized. But as I said, we are hindered a little bit by the short time frame that I've got to work on the seed. So just as you're ready to make a breakthrough, you sort of run out of the seed. So it's looking really promising. And then I attended a conference, as I mentioned to you just before we started this, in San Diego last month. And I chatted to a lot of the people who's working with oaks. And we had really good discussions. And everybody agrees that the signs are good and that we will get swamp myrie to survive this cryo process just by a couple of tweaks that we're going to do. So we're going to make that temperature even lower. So going from minus 190, we're going to go to minus 210 degrees Celsius, to get them to freeze even faster. And then just looking at where in the process can you give them more antioxidants when they recover. So I think we're just about there. And the thing with cryopreservation, a lot of it's also skills and knowledge based, isn't it? So as you learn how to do it, you get more efficient and better. So 2 years back, I was quite clumsy, and now it's getting better. And I've got a student working with me as well so we can effectively double the amount of work that we're doing. So, and that helps skills transfer to her as well. So,
That is excellent to hear. I mean, it is so good to hear like little highlights of success and something that's moving the process forward, because I think we do focus a lot on the bad stuff. And trust me, there is plenty of bad stuff out there going on. But to highlight these successes and know that someone's working on it, whether it's known or not, that is so nice.
Yes, it is. It is. We should celebrate our successes as well, because conservation isn't always a happy story, is it?
No, unfortunately. Which makes me think of another species I've been reading about and learning about your work is the, now I apologize, I'm an East Coast North American guy here, so I might butcher this, but Bartlett's rata?
Not bad. Bartlett's rata, that's correct.
Okay.
So that's Metrosideros Bartlett. Yeah, it's still Metaceae, so it's still one that's threatened by the myrtle rust that we've got. And actually, Bartlett's rata is more severe or more dire in its situation than swamp moray. Because Bartlett's rata is down to 13 individuals. And of those 13, there's only 5 genotypes. So only 5 of them aren't related to each other. So that's quite dire. And then it's really common in cultivation. But if you recall right when we started off, I mentioned briefly about cuttings and taking clonal material and how that's not really suitable for reintroductions.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what happened to Bartlett's rata. So yes, it's common in cultivation. But it's all clonal. It's from one tree. Then we add another layer. This tree is self-incompatible. Now, that means that the tree cannot use its own pollen to make seeds, viable seeds, produce viable seeds. It needs a different genotype to produce seeds. So this is the value of having a living collection in the garden as well. So it's a tree. It's quite a big tree. And we had our tree flowering for the first time 2 years ago. And we partnered with the Papa Museum, who's also based here in Wellington. And they've got a pollination specialist. And we came together and we said, okay, well, let's do this. Let's make sure this tree is self-incompatible, so it won't use its own pollen. But at the same time, we managed to track down one different genotype that was in cultivation. And we got the flowers sent down to us by overnight courier so we can get hold of the pollen. And we did the pollination experiment using the pollen from the same tree and then the pollen from this different genotype. And we managed to get about 1,200 seeds.
Whoa.
from the pollen that came from the other tree. So now we know it's definitely self-incompatible. That's no way. We can't do it any other way. It has to be a different genotype. So we managed to get those seeds. We propagated about a fifth of the seed, because first of all, we wanted to know that the seeds are viable, because it doesn't really help if you produce non-viable seeds.
Right.
So we wanted to know, are they viable? And also, what percentage of the seeds are viable? Now, this genus, Metrosideros, characteristically actually produces quite low seed viability. So they'll produce hundreds of thousands of seeds. It's very, very small seeds. And then only a very small portion, sometimes as little as 10% of those seeds are actually a viable.
Oh, wow.
So we did the viability test and we managed to get it up to about 50% viability, which is,
woohoo!
Yes, that's quite good. And we've got those little seedlings growing. So we had them in the incubator and then we multiplied them. So we effectively expanded the population and then we stored the seed, remember, back in the conventional method. So they're okay if we dry them down and we put them at minus 20. So we've got the seed there. And at the moment, we're waiting to see if the tree is going to flower again this year, which we really hope it does. Last year, interesting, none of the Bartlett's rata flowered in New Zealand.
Huh.
And that shows us the risk of working with these things. So we're all geared and ready to deal with this highly threatened species. And it didn't flower, so we missed the entire year. But we're hoping this year it will flower again. And we're going to repeat the process, but now we're going to start looking at pollen. So everything I told you about seed, about how we can dry them and store them at minus 18 or minus 200 or whatever you want to store them at, we can actually do with pollen as well. So what we do, the same process. We determine pollen viability. We determine how quickly does the pollen lose its viability at room temperature and how can we store that pollen using minus 18 or minus 200 degrees Celsius, and is the pollen actually desiccation sensitive? Now, if we answer these questions, that opens an enormous door for us, because it means that if our genotypes are flowering, we can collect their pollen and we can store it for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 1,000 years, and have it ready for when the other one flowers and is ready to be pollinated. Yeah. So you can see how extreme. And I do have to say that the trees are also not reproducing in the wild anymore. So there's reproduction failure in the wild because the numbers are so low. So that will enable us to actually start hand pollinating trees, both in cultivation and in nature, and get literally hundreds of thousands of seeds. So there is no reason why this tree should go extinct, because we've got the ways and the means to save it. It's just making sure we get it done, you know, and not miss out all the time.
Yeah.
So that's a really exciting project. So we were very, very excited about the results we had. And as I said, a little bit disappointed when we saw no flowering last year. But literally every day I go and I check on this tree to see if there's any flowers for us this year so that we can continue the work.
Wow. I mean, I just kind of got goosebumps thinking of the potentials there and the fact that, you know, it isn't too late. But again, you know, you're always up against nature doing what nature's going to do and time and effort. And but again, the fact that all of this is possible and the work has been done to make it possible is so encouraging.
Exactly. We can't control nature. I mean, the climate determines if it's going to flower or not. But I think what really scares me is when I look back over maybe a year or a season, and I think, what have we not done this year that we could have done? And how is that going to impact work going forward? And I think Bartlett's Rata is quite a good example, because we've got myrtle rust. We've only got 5 genotypes, right? We didn't waste the time. But if we just say, yeah, we'll get around to it maybe in a year or 2 or 3, because we don't actually have the time or the resources now, and that tree goes extinct, are we going to be happy with ourselves? Are we satisfied that we tried everything we possibly can? Or will we always say resources got in the way? So I'm always hesitant to say, oh, we don't have the resources, because you can't come back from it. If something's gone extinct, it's gone. You know, it's not
right.
Money should stop it. We shouldn't miss opportunities if you can realistically get it done.
Yeah, I agree. And in thinking about that, you know, obviously my listener base gets very fired up about conservation. People listening care about this. I mean, is there anything the average listener can do to help maybe your work or people doing similar work around the world? I mean, what can be done to help ex situ conservation efforts like this?
I think for ex situ conservation in general, it's an awareness of the importance of it. Because if there is an awareness, there will be support, you know, whether it's from a political or a strategic point, or whether it gets written into legislation or just into everyday practices. If people are aware of it, it is supported. So just realize the value, realize how people are working in it and the dedication and what a difference it can make. And that, in terms of us as well, being a botanic garden and a public-facing botanic garden, is if people are here and they're supporting and acknowledging the work that we do, it gives us ammunition to drive that even more. And then if there is local gardens, botanic gardens, see if there's a way that you can get involved in. As I said, for us, it's absolutely fundamental that we have volunteers to help us, because we're not a big garden, but to come in and process seed. And people are often really surprised when we say, of course you can come and help us. It's not, you don't have to have worked in a lab before. You don't even have to do the lab sessions. You can do seed cleaning, slot in where you are comfortable to slot in. And yeah, as I said, just be out there and talk about conservation and exit in seed banking and botanic gardens and taxonomy and plants and the plight of plants and what we need to do about it.
Yeah, fantastic advice. And anyone listening wants to learn about your work or the work going on at the Botanical Garden, how do you recommend they reach out and find out more?
Yeah, I'm more than happy for people to email me. So I'm sure I can flick the email address through. You've got the email address.
But yeah, I'll put that up.
Okay, you'll put it up. So
yeah.
That, which saves me about a minute. That's a long pseudonym. And then we've got a website. It is at the moment being ramped up a bit for the conservation. But if you Google Wellington Gardens, you should come up with the Wellington City Council, which we are managed by, and find your way into the Wellington Gardens. And in there will be links to publications as well. There's a couple of articles that we've written on the work, like the Bartlett's Rata, and I can flick those links through to you if people want to see it and read more about it and follow some blogs from us or to Papa. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. I put up all the links on the show notes for this episode. But Karen, thank you so much for enlightening us on this process. I mean, you blew me away. That's some incredible work, and I'm so happy people like you are willing to sit down and make the effort to protect and safeguard species well into the future. Thank you so much for talking to us.
No worries. Thank you very much for your interest. I was more than happy to share.
Of course. Well, have a great day.
I will. You have a great evening.
Yep. Cheers.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye, Matt.
Pretty fascinating stuff, eh? I thank Karen for taking time out of her busy schedule to talk to us about what it takes to preserve some species that don't lend well to ex situ conservation efforts. It's incredible stuff, and I highly recommend you check out the links that I've provided for this episode to learn more about what's going on to protect what is essentially some of the rarest species on our planet. Before I leave you today, I have two big shoutouts to give to our latest producers on the In Defense of Plants podcast. Thank you to Paul from Grow Wild and Jaden. Both of them went over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and became patrons at the producer credit level. So not only do they get all of the initial kickbacks that you can get for smaller donations, they're getting all of the other kickbacks that you can get at the different levels in which you can become a patron. So go check that out. Again, it's patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And as a reminder, don't forget to check out my conversation over at Planted, Finding Your Roots in STEM Careers. Just check the show notes for this episode and you can get there really quickly. As always, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. I literally couldn't be doing this without all of the wonderful support you give me from week to week. I really appreciate it. And of course, if money isn't your thing, at the very least, consider reviewing this podcast on whatever pod portal you use to download it. Reviews help In Defense of Plants reach wider audiences. And if we're going to cure plant blindness, or at least get people caring about plants, we gotta get them listening. So yeah, that's it for this week. Until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.